When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this extremely special one-off episode of the One Heat Minute Productions podcast. I'm, of course, your host, Blake Howard. A couple of years ago, I had an idea to do what I'm calling the Decade Project, which would be a mixture of reappraising and like via essays or interviews or podcasts, films that actually still hang around, because in the 400 odd new movies that come every year, plus the 500 odd TV shows that one of my guests has to cover some of them, and I don't even know how she does it, it's really hard for things to cut through. And for anyone who knows the shows that we do, you know that certain films, once they kind of get their hooks in me, that's it. They're mine for life. And the people who make them, I am ride or die for them, permanent ticket. If I'm buying a subscription, it's to whatever they're making. And today is ridiculous because as part of the Decade Project, well, this is obviously 2023. So we're going back to 2013. And one of the films that was released in 2013 is a film that I think in Australia, if I'm really fair, we didn't probably even get it until 2014 or extremely late in 2013 at the time that it actually came around. I saw it and I was staggered by it. I almost couldn't watch it again for some time. It haunted me. It moved me. It was just utterly sensational. So I thought I'd reach out to my friend and friend of 1 8 Minute Productions, one Macon Blair, and say, Macon, you know the absolutely stunning, terrific calling card of your career, One Blue Ruin, would you want to come and have a chat with me about it? And he said, why don't we make this a party and I'll invite one Jeremy Saulnier along? And I said, well, why don't we make it a bigger party and I get my favorite person who I've ever read writing about the films of Jeremy Saulnier, of Macon Blair, one Roxana Haddadi. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Decade Project. This is Blue Ruin. Roxana Haddadi, Macon Blair, Jeremy Saulnier. Hello.
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 It's good to be here.
Oh, I'm so happy. I'm just buzzing right now. Rox, this is pretty cool. We had some fun conversations about the prospect of talking to these lovely gentlemen about this incredible film?
I don't know. Did we have conversations, or did I just send you like a string of exclamation point emojis? Like, I think that was mostly it. But yeah, this was tight.
Gents, thank you so much for doing this. 10 years between drinks. 10 years. Does it feel like 10 years, or does it feel like a goddamn blur?
A blur for sure.
Yes.
100% blur. Yeah.
So can you take us back? I want to talk about everything that you guys can remember, everything that this film is, because one of the things that I love about it is, and there's so many things that I was watching again last night to just before we got started on it. I've seen this film countless times since it was released, but watching it again, I'm just struck by everything that you did, Jeremy, and everything that Macon does, and putting him in the frame on the fringes of American society. And I just love this so much. I grew up on a beach town, and like the film opens up in these sort of coastal towns. And I just love these views of like being able to hide in, I guess, in the corridors that people don't usually have in society, like metaphorical corridors of society, where you're just navigating these liminal spaces that are between places, and people are so interested in themselves that they don't get to see you. And I just love that that focus is such Blue Ruin. It's just that you're living on the fringes, you're here. And I think that Roxanne has written so beautifully about it. Just this like glacially slow pace lures you into this, I guess, false sense of what this movie is. And then it just hits you with absolutely everything that is a gut punch. When you were making this, Jeremy, when you were thinking about it and conceiving of the idea, like, how did it start? Can we go back there?
When we first hopped on this call, I mentioned, like, it's been a long time since I've spoken to humans, let alone in a sort of public forum. But, you know, the Blue Ruin origin story, you know, I haven't watched it in probably 8 years.
Wow.
Because it's so special to me. And when I dig in and I am within centimeters of every frame for so many months and finally fix all the audio tweaks we need for the final mix and this and that and release it, I kind of put it to bed forever. But over the years, it's been romanticized in my mind and is now a perfect movie. So I never want to watch it knowing that I'll probably just see all the flaws. But you know, the origin of Blue Ruin is, it is all you said. There is all that intention there.
Yes.
But primarily it is a pragmatic engineering of how to showcase our collective talents, you know, Macon, myself, and all those involved. And while it does explore the fringes, it's really, of all the films I've done, the most near and dear and close to just my heart. And so while it was a traditional revenge story with this sort of unhoused person on the fringes and on, you know, we called him at the time a beach bum, Blue Ruin originated as a comedy premise. Because Macon's fucking hilarious. And this is a film built from our old haunts. Location is as important as plot as far as the origin. And so we both grew up going to the Delaware Shore for vacation. And it's a great place to hang out. And we both know it from our youth. And so, you know, let's get Macon Blair in a comedy role, playing a beach bum, and see what happens. And then as our careers sort of, I wouldn't say stuttered. Yeah, okay, stuttered. these sort of comedy ambitions I had, you know, I think I did a lot with Murder Party, our first film together. Mm. And that was a blessing and a curse. It wasn't intended to be what I want to make for the rest of my career, but it was indeed a calling card. So Blue Ruin was a course correction for both Macon and myself. But it was really, you know, getting a list of available locations and revisiting these childhood haunts. You know, my childhood home, Macon's family's property called East 100 in Southern Virginia, the Delaware Shore, and building a story from scratch, how to make a movie for as little money as possible. And then it became much more intentional dramatically as it was written and developed.
Macon, can you tell us about that process when you're thinking that, and firstly, an alternate universe of you being the beach bum a la McConaughey. I mean, I'm down for it. I'm just letting you know that we're all down for it. And if there is that in your future, hopefully this is me speaking it into existence. But can you talk about going from something funny? Because I certainly know that you're funny and sardonic and clever. So when it was this, like, how did you just go, no, instead this is just going to be an open wound. I'm going to give absolutely all of myself. Because that's the thing about, I think, about your performance that continues to strike me. It's like, even talking to you casually now, like, you're usually smiling and happy and this. And when I look at you in that movie, you're just every emotion that people don't want to touch. They want to be away from it. And you're just all of it encapsulated in a human being.
Oh, well, that is very kind of you to say. I was very disappointed in Jeremy, and I was just disappointed in everything. Because I had my heart set on a comedy. No, I mean, like, we kind of started out making these little movies together, and they were always comedies in some way. Maybe it was sort of like a reluctance to, like, be sincere or something, but at any rate, they were always funny. And the first movie we did was funny, or it was intended to be funny. And then we had another couple of scripts that we were developing as a group, and they were similarly, you know, they were comedies of sort of different genres, and they were never able to get made. And then Jeremy said that he was going to write this beach movie, which was also going to be a comedy, and the Dwight character was going to, like, it was going to open with him stealing a rotisserie chicken out of a deli and, like, eating it while he ran away from the cops, and all, like, slapstick broad stuff that was very, very comfortable for me. And I was really like, okay, we can do this. And then I remember we kept having these meetings, and I remember Jeremy as being kind of like a little cagey, where he was like, yeah, it's not going to be that funny, kind of. And then it kind of went to, like, actually it's going to be pretty dark. And then he was like, I'm close to a first draft. It's pretty much pitch black. And then I read the script, and it was like a wonderful script, but I was really daunted by it, because my experience with acting up until then was all in movies that were done by friends, and they were all comedic in nature, and this would be something very different. So it was it was scary. Also, not just the nature of that role, but also the fact that that character was kind of the only one in, you know, he's kind of like the whole movie, for better or worse. And if it doesn't work, if I stunk up the joint, then the whole movie is not going to work, whatever great stuff Jeremy did. It just, and so I was very, very nervous, and initially was quite like uptight about it. And Jeremy really had to kind of, like, I don't know how he did it. It was some sort of hypnosis thing, but basically chill me out, you know, and tell me to relax and take a deep breath and not overthink it so much. And we were able to get into a rhythm with it, which was also, to be clear, happening simultaneously with, like, we out in the woods in Virginia with, you know, the crew was like 11 or 12 people, tiny little crew just driving around in, like, two cars and a van, grabbing shots where we could. And it was so much fun. And so that was also kind of at odds with a very grim dramatic performance, because it was kind of like, you know, just like we were kids again in high school, running around with a VHS camera, you know, making movies in our parents' backyards when we were kids. But it felt like that with professional stakes, and the idea that Jeremy would default on his mortgage if it didn't work, because he had invested all his own money in it. So you know, it was pressurized. It was also a dream, and we talk about it a lot, about being very, very grateful for everything that's happened since then, but also wanting to, in a perfect world, be able to go backwards and have that be the, you know, the circumstances again, where it's just a bunch of buddies that get to make a movie totally on their own terms, for better or worse, and kind of do whatever they wanted. So yeah, I remember it very fondly. It's a special time for me in my life.
I can also add, you know, now that 10 years have gone by, Macon was a huge influence on me as a filmmaker and as a writer, and partially admiration and partially fucking frustration. Because we would endeavor to make these movies, yes, indie comedies, kind of in the early aughts vein. And Macon and our buddy Chris and, you know, among our collective would write these cool, bigger scripts, you know, 11 million and above. And Macon was an expert at dark crime. And as we were waiting for our indie comedy to go, and it did not, I was sitting there fuming, like, why do these pricks always write scripts that we can't make? They're super good, but they go out and they get optioned or whatever, and they get churned through the mill, you know, whatever the industry would do to them. And so I was like, influenced by a script Macon wrote called The Sinners. And he, you know, I really felt, you know, we can do this shit, but these goofballs aren't as production savvy as me, because I was a cinematographer and we all crewed and PA'd, but I'd been a gaffer and a sandbag conveyor and whatnot, and was working as a indie cinematographer. And so really knew the ins and outs of production and how to really engineer a new model to fix what I thought was broken. But The Sinners Macon script was an influence as far as like, let's both get out of our comfort zone. I won't do a zany comedy. Let's go artful. Let's go, as you said, an open wound, you know, very, very emotional and high risk, because Murder Party was done by a team, you know, and I led that team, but it was because we couldn't afford a good looking movie. Our short film in 2004 looked better than that. Murder Party was shot on standard definition. And so we said, let's make it sleazy and goofy. And if they're laughing at us, it's okay. It was cover. It was still fun. And now I'm very fond of the experience. High school friends came together, but Blue Ruin was that course correction. And it was about, let's actually try to do what we want to do. And so that was the big thing is Macon's writing. It's fantastic and very influential in the creation of this movie.
I apologize for the mystery. I don't mean to scare you. You're not in any trouble. I just thought you should be somewhere safe when you found out. With somebody. He's going to be released.
I know this is personal. That's how you'll fail.
I'd forgive you if you were crazy, but you're not. You're weak.
Hello. It's me. By my count, that's two of yours and two of mine. I don't know how this ends.
That's how this works, man. The one with the gun gets to tell the truth.
Oh.
You two are just adorable. We're just eating this up. There's something, so people would know listening to my stuff, and I know that Rox and I both have this affinity, is a long time ago, I was listening to like a comedian and a filmmaker in Australia called Tony Martin talking about his he's a big cinephile, and he's like, my favorite movies are movies that actually show how things are done from a procedural nature. It's the Manny Farber termite art thing. And that is something that I've really flipped on so much in especially Blue Ruin and other parts of your work, is you really fixate on all of the details, especially because life is such a messy, and this is such a quagmire. The minute that Dwight gets into this, it's just like everything is messy, everything is clumsy. But I just love your attention to detail, Jeremy. Both of you guys have this visual sense of like, I'm going to show you every single element of all these weird procedures in his life, whether it's the garbage bag for his battery or whether it's, you know, the keys around his neck and what he keeps for certain things, and going into his sister's house, even in the conclusion of the film, of fixing the broken window and putting the keys back through the slot, like those little things. I wonder if that was an intentional thing, because I feel like this is such a challenge, like an elemental kind of like throwdown to me of like, when you make this genre, so much of this stuff is glossed over, when in fact the messy humanity of all of these little fastidious things that the characters do is actually how you get to the core of that open wound. And I was just wondering if that was a conscious, and I'm sure there was a huge amount of intentionality, but I just want to sort of break down some of that choice, because I loved it watching it last night. I'm just like, I love all these little peccadillos that Dwight has and that Macon has in this performance. I'm just like, I love it. I love it.
Can for I say sure. mine?
It's my hand to ask each.
Oh, sorry. All I was going to say is that my favorite is after you stab Wade, you personally make it. and you pick up the knife, which is great, but then we also see him turn the faucet off and like leave bloody fingerprints. Yes. So there are all these tiny moments of like, for a character, unintentional process, just like the muscle memory things that we do as human beings. And then, yes, the very intentional, like, I'm going to Ben, destroy physical evidence of my presence, wipe the phone, all of that stuff. So, yeah, I echo Blake. I would love to know how that stuff was, like, scripted and thought of and all that jazz.
I'll let Jeremy speak to how it was thought of, but I just wanted to jump in with the, it was definitely intentional, because even in the previous movies that we were developing, Jeremy was really interested in, and it seems to have always been interested in process, and it was never really articulated this way, but looking back on it, I kind of realized that I think it was sort of like, it, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeremy, but the process or procedure can equal character, and like I would tend to get fixated on dialogue or other things. Jeremy's very interested in physical process as a way to show character. And so you mentioned the turning off the water. He comes back later in the movie and does the exact same thing, because
turn the water
he had to flee and he left it on, but he is not one to leave a mess or leave something out of order when it should have been taken care of, whether it's turning off the water at a murder scene or sweeping up the glass because villains have like home invaded, you know, like whatever the things are, which are completely outrageous and like what. But I love it because it says something very specific in particular about this character without him ever needing to say, I don't ever leave a mess, you know. You see him do it and you kind of either know it on a conscious level or not, but you know it. And I'm very fond of that.
There's a commentary track just waiting to happen where you just do all the really trite kind of like genre things in there. I never leave. Just make you do it. Voiceover. I never leave a mess.
Yes.
Whatever. I would buy that. If that I would like buy a it. Steel kit. If that was like a Steelbook 4K. Are you kidding me?
I'm in.
Yeah. All right, Jeremy, tell us all the details.
No, it's true. It's how my brain works, and also, again, this is a sort of a reaction to other movies. And in the early aughts, you know, into the 2010s, indie film was people in a room talking. And that's what you're told to do. And Murder Party is that. I was told that's what you do. And I've shot movies like over the course of a weekend, and it's people in a house talking. And it's fucking hard. It is the lighting and time of day continuity to make two or three script days happen over, you know, 18 shoot days over 3 weeks, it's very difficult. So one of the missions of this movie was silent storytelling, purely visual when I could. And then when there's dialogue, we go all in. We just sit there, we park the camera, we choose one lens, and we let the actors just do it all. I don't do shit. I just sit back and observe. But along the way, when we were getting notes back from allies in the industry, people just have these normal reactions. Could you start with a flashback of Dwight's parents getting killed? And it's just kindly, no, and then I'm not going to read the rest of your comments. Because that's a normalization of what we do. And if we were trying to compete with revenge sagas, we would lose. So what do? It's the simple premise of like, okay, what would I do? For real though, not like what do I wish I would do and how I would come across, but knowing me, knowing Macon, knowing humans around me, how would we actually behave and falter and triumph, if you can call it that, or succeed? And what are the consequences? And so that was just really, I would say just wrote itself, but as you went through, you realize like, man, you know, this hasn't really been done like this before, with a very inept protagonist just thrust into this very traditional arc. And then I think that's what adds to the tension is his attention to detail. He's polite. When he makes a mess at his sister's house, he cleans it up. He comes back at great risk to right his wrongs. And immediately after the act feels regret and has to sort of sit the bulk of the movie stewing in that. And the physicality and the nuance of what one might do was again engineered for cost reasons, for me not wanting to hear myself or others talk too much and challenge ourselves to tell a story visually and create character with action and gesture and not so much on the nose dialogue.
That all of that though was not clear to me when Jeremy, as I was saying earlier, was indicating that he was pivoting away from a comedy version and was, it's like, we're going to do a more straightforward revenge tale. And so all of that was, I wasn't aware of it yet. And so I was very much imagining Taken, and I really thought that he was off base, because I thought he was saying, like, he was suggesting that this was going to be a tough guy protagonist who is kicking ass and very sure-footed. And I just felt like that was, no one was going to buy that with me. Like, you're going to have to cast somebody else in this role if he's going to be a, you know, a two-fisted brawler. But then he assured me that it'll be the opposite of that. And then I said, oh, okay, well then that's different. We can do that. So.
But I feel like what works really well with that is sort of the duality of, like, it seems almost depressingly easy physically to kill someone, but it also feels like the emotional toll of that is just so inverse, so outsized. So, like, I love the balance of the performance in that way. There's sort of this, at least for me, very uncomfortable ease with, like, it just takes two stabs to end someone's life. But then, as Jeremy said, it's like you're sitting in that, like, what else could I have done? What's the guilt of this throughout the film? So it's like, of course, it was probably never going to be a Taken, but I just love what it actually ended up being because of that contrast.
And I do believe to this day that this film would never have gotten made, gone through the proper pipeline.
Yes.
Because of those notes. And because in the end, you know, to your point, Blake, this movie is the cutting room floor of any other action movie.
Yes. It's the difference between the mechanic with Charles Bronson and the mechanic with Jason Statham.
Great.
So you watch the Bronson and it's like a meticulous, slow 22-minute opening where you're watching someone walk around an apartment, and the whole point of, and the phrase "the mechanic" is so that, like, he's gone in there to orchestrate a death scene that he can never be traced or tracked for. And even the police are mystified, even if they suspect that it may be someone who's orchestrated it. And then Jason Statham's like exploding cars and head kicking people. And you're like, this is not the same. Just don't call it the same thing. Call it anything else. But I also love the signposts, and I love the people that Dwight encounters. And one of my favorite, Ben Gaffney, played by Devin Rattray, is just so the best. Like, I just love him. I smile. I know that this movie is not meant to be a comedy, but just like the line last night that got me is I just had to wait for him to point the gun at you, so I was fine. Like, so I was okay to shoot him in the face. And I was just like, this is just the weird morality of death. And you've got the, I guess, the very realistic reality, or I guess a much more relatable reality for me, of like, oh my God, like Dwight's coping with the fact that he's having to point a gun at someone and he's just killed someone with a knife, and maybe he's done the wrong thing and now this is all crushing him. And then his mate's like, no, I'm good. I that was a good kill. You know, he pointed the gun at you, I killed him. I just love that balance, because when they clash together, it's electric.
Well, that's procedure too. That was like Ben's procedure of like, I can get into my sniper position, but I will not shoot until X, Y, and Z happens. And then I can. And
yes.
You know, it's he has a procedure that he goes through as much as I guess anybody else does, which is.
Yeah, I actually interview my friends for movies, and the character Ben is based on my buddy Ben. He's part of our posse from back in grade school and beyond making movies. And he is a gentle person. He's not a combat veteran, but he likes guns. and I modeled this character after that. And I asked Ben, like, how do you feel about revenge in this scenario? And he's like, I'm totally against it. And I was like, shit, okay. So Dwight's not going to get a cheerleader. And I like that. He's like, you know, he's kind of neutral, and it's waiting for Teddy to point the gun is also a liability issue.
Yes.
It's like, I want to help Dwight, but I'm not going to go down for this dude right now. So I incorporate, I even asked my buddy what his gun collection was, and that, you know, there's whatever we could get from our armor mimics that collection.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, the reality is I'm really not that creative. I just know who to talk to.
Yeah. Okay. We'll just let, we're just
no,
gonna
literally
that.
No one is going to buy that, but okay.
Yeah, I'm not, we're not buying this.
Okay. Okay. I put a lot of research into my films.
Yeah, that's, yeah. That's fine. Better. That's better. Fine.
Macon, I want to know, so like making this transition from like the intended comedy to the drama, was there like a backstory that you created for Dwight in those years that he's been missing? Did you do any of that like mental sort of gymnastic stuff? Or were you able just to get into the character? And then like follow up, was there a scene that was like the most difficult for you?
Oh, yeah. Jeremy and I talked a lot about like what he had been doing, and like a lot of that was born out of like me asking questions of Jeremy, like why the battery in the bag, like, well, because of this, and like what all of these very particular details about Dwight's campsite or his vehicle that he kind of lives in, or you know, just any of the things that he does to survive, kind of asking about that. And Jeremy tended to have very clear ideas about what that was going to be. And if he didn't, then we would kind of talk about it and come up with something. But I wouldn't say it was like a whole history that had been memorized. It was definitely more of kind of like taking it on a scene by scene basis and trying to make sure that I was doing justice to what he wanted. Part of that was sort of knowing what came before, but I would say more of it was trying to, you know, be more present for that moment that we were in, which to your second question, I think the one that I remember being the most difficult, but also the most kind of exciting and thrilling was the very long conversation with his sister in the diner. Because there was, I just had this remarkable scene partner to work with, Amy Hargreaves, and it was a ton of dialogue, and there wasn't a lot of business to rely on. It's not like he's walking around and you could do stuff to kind of, like, you really just had to sit still and look at this other person and have it feel authentic, which was daunting for me. Like I said, you've got someone like Amy sitting across from you, that makes it easier. But as we started getting into that scene, that's when it became thrilling, because it was just so fun to play off of Amy. Prior to that, very nervous, didn't sleep very well the night before, and was like, of all the times to really tank Jeremy's movie, this is going to be the one.
And to add a little something to that, that was the day we lost our sound mixer.
Oh, that's right. The producer was doubling as the boom op.
Yeah, the producer was on this the audio recorder, didn't realize that what he was turning up was the monitor and was not turning up the signal. So the audio levels were so low, and it was by far the most, it was the core of the movie. It was the heart of the characters and the single most important dialogue scene in the movie. And of course, we barely got through it, but yeah, that's what I was referring to when it was just the filmmaking sort of stopped and I just let the actors go. Cause honestly, not only was it really important dramatically and narratively, it saves a shit ton of money. Mm-hmm. It's a 12-page scene. Mm-hmm. And all these descriptive passages of, you know, Dwight does this, Dwight does that, he goes here, touches that. That's a quarter page and ends up being X amount of minutes. But this was like, I wrote it 12 pages. We shaved it down to about, I think, a 7 or 8 minute scene. And it's just, that method has influenced me on every movie where I can implement it. Is that when I have important dialogue, I don't like a lot of coverage anymore. I like the philosophy of you pick a lens that's appropriate and you just do a couple, 3, 4, 5 takes. And that's all you get, because then you're not forced to find the best performance in the close-up, which is hard. It's a little jarring going from medium, close, wide, wide, medium, close. When you just pick two lenses and point them at actors, you know, it lets it be so present. And it's hard to find that in sort of, you know, studio filmmaking for sure. But yeah, that was a crazy day.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I think from the standpoint of like the little shots taking more time and the big scenes being more efficient, I could be wrong. I might be misremembering this, Jeremy, but I think the scene that we had to do the most takes on was just a close-up shot on Dwight turning off a lamp, and it was really just his hand coming in towards the end. And there was something about, like, you know, it was like an insert shot. And so there was sort of like a technical, like the hand had to come in a certain way, but it you know, it was something that we had to do like a dozen takes or something to turn off the lamp, because like,
hey man, that shit made the UK trailer.
it's a great shot, and it's worth twice as many takes. I'm just saying, compared to.
Yeah, I got shit on this last movie I did. It was technically very tough, but I was doing like 13, 14 takes. because there was so many moving parts. But Blue Ruin, their rule was like, if we get two good ones, we're just moving on.
Yeah.
Because all I want in the edit room is a choice. And if I get two good ones, then I'm a lucky dude. So moving on.
Yeah. But I do love that. That's, do you want this shot to go in the UK trailer? I love that you could use that in future film sets. We're going to do it fucking 14 times. UK market, love this shit. Fantastic. There's a line that last night I wrote down, and I may have ballsed it up, but I feel like it's like an evocation of the whole genre. You know, people sometimes, you know, I know that Tarantino calls these things revenge-o-matics or revenge, you know, stories or whatever, but I just love it so much. And I wanted to talk to you about it because Devin Rattray, Ben Gaffney gets it. You point the gun, you shoot the gun. And when I hear that line, I'm like, that's the kind of like, the exegesis of this whole movie. It's like he's making the choice. He has to do it. You point the gun, you shoot the gun, and it's the wearing of the consequences of that. And I wrote down in my notes, I was like, these motherfuckers are just throwing these lines away, like these lines that just go, like in the as the biggest compliment as I can give you ever is that some of the lines in this movie hit me like a Mack truck, and then you just drive over me again because you've got another one coming to follow it up. But that line particularly got me on the last viewing. You point the gun, you shoot the gun. And I feel like that the burden of that line, you know, he might be saying it, Ben's just saying it in that passing moment, you point the gun, you shoot the gun, you can't mess this up. And it feels like then that line informs Dwight for the rest of the movie. And there's that great quandary scene where he comes out and he points the gun at the family. And then he makes the choice, okay, I might just get out of here. I might do it. This might just be too much. And he hides back behind the wall, and then they start reacting to his voicemail. And then he just comes back out from behind the wall and he points the gun. You point the gun, you shoot the gun. And I was just like, that's, I don't know. I these little lines last night got me again, better and bigger, I think, than they ever have before.
Why the fuck was that line not in the UK trailer?
That should have been like the poster line.
I will add another line, which is my favorite in the movie. And despite, you know, really, I am proud of the script. I had a great time writing it, and it was a collaborative process, but I got to sit in a chair and really interpret things and process things. But and making, I think you might have added it at the script phase, but
let's
it was
just say that I did.
Either that or on the day. But I remember in that same sequence with Dwight's childhood friend Ben, when Teddy is felled, it's this moment, you know, that also speaks to the film and the overarching themes. Is once it's too late and Teddy's face comes apart, Dwight just says, wait. And it's too late. It's already happened, but it's that confusion and that just injection of humanity and regret. And I was like, bravo, Megan. Your one word is kind of equal to the other, you know, 400 in the script. But
that sound mix, and I think the weight falls between sound of gun shooting and bullet hitting. It's like this perfect bridge of like you hear in the mix in the left speaker and you're like, whoa, what is that? Wait, bang. And he's just down and you're like, oh, that's this character.
Yes. And that edit, like, and that edit I worked very hard on because that's like frame accurate to confusion and interrupting the flow of the narrative. And like, maybe a line was going to come or something. And it's just this awkward, like, wait, what's happening? Boom, it's over. Wait. And oh, fuck, I didn't want that. You know, because I think Dwight was seeing, he was, things were revealed to him. And I think Dwight was sinking and saying, this is pretty much it for me. This is my state is, my fate is sealed. And I kind of want to go.
Yeah.
And then intervention occurs and he's like, fuck, wait, no, not you. Oh, never mind. on with the movie.
Now I'm in so deep. Now I'm in so deep. I can't, there's no getting out.
See, I should have had that line in there.
No, that's in the make. That's in the making special features that we're going to get in the 4K. Now I'm right. in so deep.
No, they all have to be. They all have to be in like this Batman voice. Like that's really the key.
Yeah, a little bit out of breath.
Yeah,
too many cigarettes.
I'm almost shocked. I'm almost shocked, and I know it's coming to the 4K release, but I just know that Macon's going to start spouting lines from Vincent Hanna and Neil McCauley in the diner in Heat during he and Amy's scene in the diner. He's just going to start. You know, I got this recurring dream.
Oh, hey, this is a sidebar. Are you going to do an insider podcast?
Oh, God.
Yes. Say yes. He's asking you. You can't say no.
Thanks for peer pressure 101. Have Macon Blair say, yeah, look, I thought Macon perhaps in a flawed manner that because I really wanted to do the journalism podcast, I didn't want to follow up One Heat Minute with The Insider. So I went to All the President's Men because it's a perfect movie and one of my favorite movies. But what is nagging at me, and I genuinely say this, everyone knows in the world that I love Heat, but on its day, when I watch The Insider, when I'm watching The Insider, it's my favorite Michael Mann movie. And that's the trouble with it, with the trouble. It's just, it's so good.
It's the one that you're watching at the moment. I get it. You should call it How and Wygand.
How and Wygand?
Look at this yes. art that's coming from this.
This is so special. This perfection, is so special.
Yeah.
Come on, Macon. This is a prestige indie we're talking about here. That's
wow, man. Can we go back to that though? Because like Macon, do you remember? Was it your ad lib? Like how did that go?
It was not an ad lib for sure. Okay. No. I mean it may I think I honestly don't remember. I think Jeremy was saying that it may have been pitched in a
script discussion.
Mm-hmm. I honestly don't remember, but yeah, no, that was definitely not ad-libbed. But you know what, that day was the second, I mean, of the two times in the movie where people just talk for 12 mm-hmm. pages, that was the other total monster. And it was that one, for some reason, I don't know why, but it didn't scare me as much as the diner scene. But it was that was a big one to get through, just because it was sort of like that was the closest to that Liam Neeson version of the movie that I was scared of. It was sort of like he was still fumbling and a mess, but of all the times in the movie, maybe except for the very, very end, the confrontation, that was the time where he had one up on a bad guy and was kind of like, tell me the truth, and trying to extract information and stuff like that. And so trying to be credible with that. But again, there was a, you know, Kevin Kolak, who played Teddy in that scene. It's just sort of, if you have somebody who's really remarkable on the other side of it, it really does a lot of the heavy lifting for you. Not the memorization, which is difficult for me, but just sort of being hopefully credible in those moments. If you just have someone like Kevin sitting in the trunk kind of glaring at you, then it's kind of easy to feel intimidated, even if you have a weapon. And
it's implicit. Yeah. Jeremy does such a phenomenal job of framing you as the powerless one in the entire scene, no matter what. It's like you're holding a gun, and the way the camera's got, the way that you're framed in the scene, it's like you're always feeling like you're tilting and you're less powerful than Teddy is from the trunk. And I think that's what, it's just like another choice in that scene where you're like, he's not going to, you know, self-actualize into this like murderous, rage-filled, like, you know, very typical and almost like frustratingly typical revenge genre person who suddenly gains all these skills and gets all of this sort of rage. It's still that delicate balance in that scene of the power dynamic is really excellent.
Yeah, the power dynamic, and also the fear of it, which yeah. Again, Jeremy used procedure to kind of bring. He doesn't just like pop the trunk and is like, all right, tell me some shit. It's very much like, okay, I have to provide water for this guy. It's my obligation as a human being. I also have to like make sure that the trunk can be opened with the button, but I don't want to be close to him because he could, like, all this kind of preparation just to have the conversation, which otherwise could have just been like, let's talk to the bad guy. But it was almost like the conversation itself was secondary to him stage managing how to best have the conversation with some water, with some distance, with the, like, I'll press the button and then do a very wide run around circle to make sure he can't get me because I'm scared. All those little things, which, if it were a different situation, the note probably would have been like, just open the trunk and start talking. But those little physical details are important to Jeremy, and they become like, that's what the weight of the whole scene is kind of hinging on. You know, it's not the conversation, it's the space.
Yeah, and logistics. And the funny thing is, you know, we're here on Zoom, and Macon, you just touched your face, which brings back a crucial memory. So again, we're low budget movie. We shot the first third or 25% of the movie in continuity because of the beard. It gets shaved off after the murder, and he's fleeing and trying to conceal his identity to some extent, but also trying to clean up for his sister. That was the real motivation. It wasn't like, you know, I'm gonna dye my hair. It's more like, I'm gonna see her. It's been a long time. I better look a little more clean cut. His kindness coming through. But when he wasn't so kind and was stabbing his victim in the bathroom, it was, again, governed by practicality. I was doing mostly, camera tripod, camera slider, dolly, traditional camera support methods. But because the bathroom stall was so confined, it was handheld, and the environment, it wasn't a set. It was a real sort of roadhouse bathroom. And so we were in there, and I was sitting there with the camera and just watching Macon and going through it. And it was good. And then, you know, but it was such a huge moan of the movie. You know, I'm not the most articulate. I don't really know how to speak to actors that well. I don't know the craft and the sort of shorthand, but I do know plot, physicality, and just sort of like what the bullet points of this story are to help the actor translate that. And on one take in particular, Macon touched his face and it did something, and it completely, I was like, this is perfect. Do that again. And we did one more take, and that was it. But it was like the scene where Dwight is trying to process these emotions and ends up leaping out of this bathroom stall and killing Wade. So, but that was present sort of throughout these things. And that scene with the Teddy Dwight standoff also came down to physicality. And I remember when we kind of got it, you know, Macon and I had not done this before. We have, you know, I had helmed a feature, but it was shot in two parts over, you know, 8 months. And it was just sort of this hodgepodge thing. But we were out here with a real schedule and a real crew and people looking at us. And we were trying to find out how to unlock these scenes. And I think one of those takes was about breath. And it really helped Macon, and it helped the camera all of a sudden felt very confident and in love with what it was seeing. And again, didn't need a ton of coverage. And that was really fun to see come alive. And it's these simple little moves, like breathe a little heavier before we start and let that resonate throughout the scene. And then you got it. And it added that to that fear and tension. And I'm big on, like, you know, close miking actors, because breath is so important when you're not relying upon so many words.
I love that when he covers his breath, like just that, in the bathroom stall, he covers his mouth so that his breath can't be heard. And then his hand sort of drapes away. It's very special. Very special.
And that was it. You know, it's like you visualize some person just standing there thinking and seething. But then when the face, it interacted, you know, his hand interacted with his face, and just it said so much. And I couldn't articulate and still can't. But I knew it when I saw it. And, you know.
Later on, it's when he covers the flashlight in the house.
Oh, God.
I love covering the flashlight in the house, because at that point it feels like as much as possible Dwight has sort of mastered the fact that, like, I'm in this now, like I'm on a path I can't turn back from, all the like emotional stuff we've talked about, but just the practicality of they can't see the flashlight light. So it's like, I love the covering the flashlight, but all those sort of things, like how this character remains self-contained, is so interesting. And the scene I think about a lot is like the failed arrow extraction. Because I love that it fails, right? It's like you have to draw a line for what this character can and cannot pull off. So I love the fact that it almost seems like in another life, or even in the years we haven't seen, Dwight has taken care of like various injuries and done various things, but like an embedded arrow is a bridge too far for him to take care of.
it's got all the makings. It's got all the ingredients of the, you know, the phenomenal 2007 No Country for Old Men kind of like, it's got all those makings. And then when he just like puts the pliers in and goes, oh, and nothing happens. And then you see him, the cut so effortless. It's just him in the hospital. I'm just like, this is great. Like, because you imagine that you're Anton Chigurh, but you're not Anton Chigurh. Like, you can't just DIY surgery out of things.
Well, and more to the point, it's like the audience has seen No Country for Old Men, and they've seen a million movies where the self-surgery hero healing himself works. And so it was like I thought that was, you know, the movie I think does its own thing, but that was one of those moments where it sort of like relies upon, I think it gets a bigger laugh because people think they know what's coming because they've seen versions of it before in other movies. And so it's kind of like, oh, he's gonna pull it out and it's gonna suck and he's gonna get bandaged, but he'll be okay. And then to kind of like do the opposite version of that, my memory is that always got by far the biggest laugh in the movie, because it starts out as such a familiar thing and then becomes unfamiliar. Before I forget real quick, because Jeremy had mentioned the beard, which became a whole scheduling thing unto itself, like locations with the beard and without the beard and actors being present when the beard was present or not. I had grown this long beard. When we were trying to cast people, nobody knew who we were, so we switched my IMDb photo for a photo with the beard on. So when people would be like, "Who's this?" Like, oh, he already is like this sort of like dirtbag. It's very easy to cast. But almost none of the crew we had worked with before, and so we met them for the first time when I was big and shaggy. And so for the first like 2 weeks of the shoot was us working together and me looking like that. We shot everything up till that point, and we were in a hotel in Charlottesville, and the next night was the beginning of the block of shooting without the beard. And so just in my hotel room with Jeremy and the hair person, we did a haircut and a shave, and then the next morning I was like in the hotel and like standing next to the crew and just kind of next to them. And I was kind of like, oh, we're going to go shoot today. And from their perspective, they were kind of nervous about, like, who is this fucking dude that's standing in front of us? And, like, it took them a good while to realize that who I was, which I thought was funny.
That's great.
It's like you only recognize the dwarves in the Hobbit movies or stuff like that when they have the full beard and the luscious hair. If they don't have it, you're just a guy.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Wow. You just...
yeah.
Macon, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
How did you decide upon Dwight's line deliveries? Because they're so interesting and they're so sort of like gentle and like hesitant, but also with increasing conviction. I'm wondering how you got there.
I remember, it's such a good question that I wish I had a better, more thought out answer for it. I think what I remember sort of locking in on, and I think there was kind of like what Jeremy was saying, we kind of experimented with different things, and if they didn't work, then we would kind of cast them aside. But I think one of them was the idea that him talking at all, regardless of what he's say, whether it's to his sister or to Ben, like whoever, like just talking in general was difficult for him. And so it's sort of like him having to gear up and get the words out, that always took a little like preheating the oven in order to get the words out. And I think a lot of that, that was either when it was finally edited was either highlighted, or if those preheating pauses were interminable, then they were cut out. But that was sort of a thought process. And I remember with shooting some scenes with Devin where he would be on, you know, it'd be my coverage and he'd be on the other side and I would be doing this protracted thing, and he'd be like literally like, fucking hurry it up, man. Like, oh, slow.
That's great.
And I was kind of like, I don't know, I'm just doing what I thought was right.
I remember, you know, we didn't have much time to prepare, but we had a rehearsal with Macon and Amy, and the dialogue could easily be interpreted as a certain way. And Amy came off the very first time we read it, you know, rightfully so, a little angry. Mm-hmm. And then I know what I said, because again, I don't say much. I said, let's shift this energy so it's a little more surreal, you know? And they did it once, and they both took it down, and it became very emotional and effective and sad and truthful. And so I was like, okay, we're done, because I really don't want to talk anymore about this until we shoot it. And that was cool, with seeing the chemistry sort of develop right then and there, and feeling that we had something in our pocket as far as whatever the fate of this movie was. That was fucking awesome. If we can get that and a few other things, and we start these waypoints in the movie that are successful, then maybe the rest that strings it all together, you know, might just work out.
Well, it's so funny that we talked about that scene, because I sometimes think of like, how the hell am I going to exit out of a conversation that I'm having so much fun with? And I'm going to say that, for folks who didn't hear, when Jeremy came into this call before we even started recording, he said, I haven't spoken to human beings. You know, I haven't been around. And it's so funny that Rox is talking about that line and Macon's delivery as Dwight going, I haven't talked in a long time. This is why I'm doing these interminable pauses. So it's funny how the osmosis comes back around to exactly how I want to conclude this conversation, which is that for a man who said that he doesn't talk to human beings, Jeremy, this has been an absolute treat. Macon, always a pleasure. Rox, thank you for being here with me to do this. And for all of you and anyone listening, this movie is a stone cold masterpiece. I love it. For whatever restrictions that you guys had as far as like timing and money, I just want to say that it is blown away by the emotional reality of what you deliver. And as a person who loves this kind of genre, I just think that it cuts so deep and so hard, and it continues to cut deep and hard. And from Roxana and I, we love your work, both of you, and we love this movie immensely. And I can speak for Rox saying that she's maybe the most gigantic fan of Green Room in the world. So we're going to have to put that on the decade project for when we get to the decade anniversary of that. But it's just been an absolute treat talking to you guys and celebrating this movie, because it lasts. And in this world, the things that last actually have the currency, and the rest of it's just trash. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And despite your awesome outro, let me fuck that up a little bit and say, like, it's an absolute pleasure to meet you. I'm an instant fan already. And Roxana, when you wrote that piece on my work, I broke down in tears.
Oh, okay.
I have been, you know, we a little off the radar recently, but this is why I make movies, so smarter people can speak about them and write about them and interpret them as they will. And when I read what you wrote, it made me feel like a success. And that is a rare thing, because I'm a self-deprecator, as is Macon. So thank you for that.
As the queen of self-deprecation, I almost want to like refuse this. But
that sounded like you were bragging just then.
I know. That's what... but that means a lot. I mean, I think that it might be sort of strange to say that I find comfort in how your films sort of normalize extreme reactions, but I do. I find it very comforting. And I thought about wearing one of my like 4 Green Room t-shirts to this, but I was like, that's too much. You know, don't do that. But yeah, it's an honor, and I appreciate speaking to you both very much. So thank you for that.
You bet.
If you do show on Green Room, you should call it Green Zoom.
Green Zoom.
See?
Done.
Look at this.
Sold.
Look at this content. Look at the... Where else would we get this?
What was the name of the Insider show? What was the name? What was the Wigan name you had? What was it?
How and Wigan.
How and Wigan.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. My God. This is the best. You guys are amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.